We all started out as someone's little angel. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamore. Today, we're talking about the 2017 film Shot Caller. The film stars Nicolaj Coster-Waldau, Omari Hardwick, Lake Bell, John Bernthal, Jeffrey Donovan, Evan Jones, Benjamin Bratt, and Holt McElhaney. Rick Roman Waugh wrote and directed the film. He also recently directed Greenland with Gerard Butler, and he previously did a couple other movies like this, Snitch and Felon. The film holds a 69% on Rotten Tomatoes, and the movie is currently on Netflix. My guest this week is my buddy Myron. Myron is a great screenwriter who is a hustler and self-starter like me. Myron has an awesome project called Infinitization, which he just directed the proof of concept short film for. What's up, Myron?
What's going on? So, I like that intro.
speaking of proof of concept short films, another movie that famously started that way was Whiplash. The company that produced Whiplash was Bold Films, which also produced this movie. I just want to give you 6 years of Bold Films. 2011, up 6 years after that. Whiplash, Nightcrawler, No Escape, Stronger, Shot Caller. That's 6 years.
Are you serious? These guys on a roll.
They were crushing it.
They know material. Oh my God. Yo, you know a funny story about Whiplash is Whiplash was so amazing when I watched that show. I sat in my car after the show, after the movie was over, for like 30 minutes thinking about my life, right? I was like, holy shit, what am I doing with my life, right? And true story, this is so true. So I took a girl I was dating to go see that movie, right?
Yeah.
After we see the movie, we come back to my house. And she's just like really quiet the whole time. And I'm like, yo, so what did you think about the movie? And she says, you know what? I think I want to be the best. She was like some ear doctor and everything. She said, I think I want to be the best ear doctor there is, or something like that, right? And I'm like, right? Isn't that right? And then after that, I never heard from her again.
She was busy being an ear doctor, I guess.
She was busy. That Whiplash movie, man, has literally moved people to be the greatest. Like, it's insane.
I saw that movie.
They did Whiplash and then Nightcrawler too. Oh my God.
They're incredible. I saw Whiplash in a theater in New York with my buddy Jesse, who listens to the show. Shout out to Jesse. We saw it like in the morning in New York, like 10 a.m. or something. Yeah. And when you get to the end and he does the drum solo, you feel like you're at a concert. People lost their stood up and applauded. People just lost their shit.
It was insane.
So we're not talking about Whiplash of the show, but just Whiplash good. Well, we could do an hour on Whiplash. All right, so Shot Caller.
Shot Caller. You know, I'm gonna say something, Dan. When you present films, right, and then you put Shot Caller, you say it was your best. I'm like, holy crap, that is such a great movie. Such a great movie, man.
Yeah, Shot Caller is like, it's funny. I think that I remembered it being more pulpy and exploitation-y than it actually is. It's interesting watching. It's very heartfelt. Like it is, it really has like a soul to it. I think you're going there. The beginning with he's writing this letter to his son, and that's such a big part of it, right? Is he's writing a letter to his son and he's saying that he's failed him in every way possible, and he is a coward for taking so long to write him. And this is a guy with white power tattoos all over his body. Did you empathize with him at the beginning of the movie?
I'm going to be honest with you, man. As a black man, right, when I seen Shot Caller and I seen the white power, and I'm like, okay, here we go. We're going to go into this world, right? I got to admit, bro, it sucked me in. Like, because it was an ordinary man in extraordinary circumstances that just had to do what he had to survive. And when he wrote that, and I watched it, when he wrote that letter to his son, because, you know, I watched it again, too. I'm like, yo, that's a poignant statement. Like, yo, he's to admit who he is. And that just draws you into the character. I think it was so amazing the way they introduced their characters. Go ahead. Yeah,
I think it's a great point. I mean, I had this question later, but we might as well go here now. Like, I think that the white power part of it is malleable, meaning that you could totally do, and I would love to watch the movie of the Latino version of this with Michael Peña. And he gets like sucked into like a Latino gang, or the black version.
Yeah.
They did this in France. They did a French Arab version of this called A Prophet, which is basically a Muslim guy and a French guy.
I watched it.
Yeah. And it's the same movie. I mean, it's just such a great clean model where it's like the guy starts at the bottom And by the end, you know he's going to be at the top, and we're going to watch him how he goes.
Well, you know, rags to riches stories. We love rags to riches stories just because America is a population of underdogs. I mean, we're talking about British colonies in America. I mean, we're just a people. So we always root for the underdog. So in a perverted way, in the underground world, this is this guy's rags to riches story. Totally. Because in most rags to riches story, you have like the drug dealer that's at the kingpin that's all flashy and all stuff. But if you notice the way they approach this dude, like he's already a king in such a gritty world. Like, you know, when the young guy approaches me, like, yo, he's all starstruck and everything. Yo, like, they revere this guy. Mm-hmm. And he started from the bottom. So it's this perverted rags to riches story in a very grimy, realistic way.
Yeah, it's not like it's that cool to be like the king, king guy of the white power gang. Like, basically, if you get to be the boss, you're left alone in a prison cell like 23 hours a day. One thing that's interesting about the movie, you're kind of referencing it there, is that they do this parallel narrative thing, which I'm obsessed with. And I've done movies like that where they're jumping back and forth in time. So we see him when he's already become the boss and he's gotten out of prison. And we see him as he is becoming the boss while he's in prison. And so early on, we see him go to this extremely sketchy party, which I love in movies. I love a scene where you see somebody go to a party and you're like, at least 50% of people in this party have killed somebody. That's a party I want to
get vibe.
Like, have you ever been to a party like that in real life? Like a party where you're like, man, some of these people in here definitely have been to prison.
Bro, hell yeah, I've been to parties like that. You want to know a real story, man? The one party that changed my life. I remember a homeboy of mine, his name was Fred. He had just got out of jail. And we went to a party and somebody stepped on his shoes and he wanted to kill the dude, right?
Oh, Fred.
And I was like, holy shit.
Don't do it, Fred.
I'm like, I need new friends. So that party, there are so many parties like that happen in the hood. Like, just those are real parties. And those people aren't bad people. Some of them just cool people that just like, that's their community. You know what I mean? It's like, oh,
they're like, hey, these Greg's white
going to party. Oh shit, yeah.
These ooh, white power guys have great beer.
yeah, you know, and good weed. You know what I mean? Let's roll. You know, so it's like
One thing I want to point out from the party scene, and they do this in the movie a lot, and it's really critical. And I think I found somewhere an interview where Rick Roman Waugh talks about meeting Nicolaj to talk to him about this part. And he said he talked for like 2 hours about subtext. There's a part where he goes to the bathroom and he's already the boss. Everybody respects him, whatever. There is no danger to him at this party that he knows of. Mm-hmm. And he goes to the bathroom and he basically has a panic attack. And then he puts on the tough front and steps out. And because of that, you continue to empathize with him. And they keep going back mm-hmm. to that, you know?
Yeah, that was a very, like I said before, it was incredible way they did that. And also, I got to get kudos because movies like that always, where they make the mistake is they try to start with him as a good guy first. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, this movie did not start with him as a good, it introduced you into his world as he is, he's morphed into. Mm-hmm. And so you're following this guy and then you're getting pieces of him.
Yeah.
And that's a very bold decision as a screenwriter, as a director and everything, because you can fear of losing your audience by not empathizing. So, because sometimes everybody wants you, oh, well, we got to have him empathize in the first 10 pages. We got to, no, this guy's like, so I get kudos, man. Like I said, it's just masterful the way they did that.
Yeah, I mean, and he's hard already at the jump because he leaves there's a shooting at the party. Someone shoots up the party and he leaves and he tells the like second banana guy, if we find out who shot up this party, put the word out, they're greenlit. So mm-hmm. you already know that he's basically gone to the edge. He's ready to kill people and like he's got no problem with that. So they're not trying to sugarcoat for you at all that like he is somehow still a redeemable character. Like he's not. But then also they show you, we jump back to 10 years prior. He is a stockbroker. He's with his wife and son. Everything's great. They got this beautiful house. The kitchen looks great. I was wondering, do you think in terms of casting, right? So Nicolaj is almost comically handsome, right? He's almost like the Prince Charming guy from Shrek. If it's a different actor, do you think it functions differently, the backstory stuff with him?
Okay. This guy, you're right. Because from what I know, he blew my mind because I didn't think he had that range. Mm. And because Hollywood is known for putting you in your boxes, and we as an audience put people in boxes. So I had put him in a box But this movie, he showed at a range that I didn't, it made me feel like, where has this guy been the whole time? Mm. He's been there the whole time. He just had the ability to stretch his chops. I mean, if you want to talk about like the way he played each role, because when you're introduced to him as the stockbroker guy, the first scene that you see of him is on the basketball court where he gets charged.
Yep.
And he takes a charge and somebody else wants to stand up for him, but he doesn't stand up for himself. And there's even some like notions of how there's some terminology about like how he's passive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think as far for that, that the guy, if it had been anybody else, I think they did a great job because it shocked you because yeah. you're seeing the transformation in real life, because even in your mind, you're transforming like, oh, shit, this guy's for real.
Yeah. So he basically the inciting incident is that he's driving his wife and friends home after dinner, including Max from New Girl. And they get into a collision, which kills one of his friends. He takes a plea deal. It's like a DUI manslaughter thing. He's only supposed to do 16 months at Chino. Then, you know, we're kind of jumping back and forth to the present. He's doing some nebulous weapons deal with a Mexican gang. There's kind of a mustache off. He's got a sweet, like, handlebar mustache.
We've seen that dude. I've seen that dude at the gas station a million times. That's I'm telling you. I've seen that dude at the gas station a million times. This movie has like, let me go ahead and just pump my gas and leave that dude alone.
Yeah, so it's him, and then the Mexican gangster has a similar mustache, and then Benjamin Bratt must have seen their mustaches and been like, you guys think you can grow a mustache? It's like really thick. Benjamin Bratt has an excellent mustache in this movie.
The mustache gang going on there. Huh?
Shocked by the brutality of prison life, Harlan stands his ground and attacks an African-American inmate when provoked, drawing the attention of Bottles, who's the shot caller for the white supremacist gang, because obviously he sees that he attacked a black guy and assumes that, hey, great, yeah. This guy could be a good white supremacist. The actor who plays the leader of the white supremacists in the prison is Jeffrey Donovan, who is so good in this part that I now pretty much think that Jeffrey Donovan is a white supremacist. He was so convincing. Do you think
we could have used more of him? Yeah, we could have used more of him. I think he was kind of like, he almost could have played a father figure. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he could have played a father figure. They could have tapped into a little bit about his morality because he seemed like he was very intelligent. Mm-hmm. He was a very intelligent guy. And I'm trying to think, like, I see that guy's face in so many different movies. Like, what else has he done that's, like, pretty?
I think he was the lead of this show called Burn Notice, which ran on.
That's right. He was. I gotta tell you, I wonder if, like, whenever they approach these guys, say, listen, Hollywood got you pegged this way. Do you want to completely unravel that? And now they're like, hell yeah, because all these guys are in there, like.
I guarantee you they do that. So there's a producer that you and I both know, Sean Thomas, who he did a movie called Becky where Kevin James plays a neo-Nazi.
Yeah.
And he and I talked about that specifically, that the reason that they went to Kevin James, the reason Kevin James wanted to do it, is he's like, hey, who else is going to let me play a neo-Nazi? And he wanted to challenge himself. So just moving ahead in the plot, in return for protection and entry into the gang, Jacob is forced to smuggle heroin up his ass, which is tough for me to watch. I got OCD with germs. This is a lot of ass smuggling of shit in this movie. And then snitch within the gang. And to me, this is the big thing that I always struggle with the movie. If he just says no, he's like, no, I'm not doing it. Like, I'll just take my chances. That would have saved his whole life. He could have like just served his 16 months. Like, he probably would have been okay. Why do you think he felt such a pressure that he had to do this? And what happens if he just says no?
He gets killed.
Yeah, but I'm saying like going into it, meaning that he goes to the white supremacists. Yeah. They pretty much tell him. There's a part where Jeffrey Donovan is like, here's the deal. If you want to be with us, you got to earn. If you don't want to be with us, you take your chances with the general population. That's the moment
where he
could have said, I'm taking my chances, peace. But instead he kind of stays.
But man, I'll tell you what. In that type of situation in jail, I mean, it's kind of like one of those – I mean, he's saying you can take a chance and place with general population, but if he becomes general population, it's like if you're not for us, you're against us. So, and then you got to think about it. He's in jail. He only got 16 months. They know how much time he has too. So he says no. You think they're just going to let him go home? I mean, what if they just green light him with the brothers that he already had a problem with? What if they just like?
I guess what I'm getting at is that the way that you if you take this movie at face value for what it's saying, it's almost like either you become white supremacist boss guy, or you die. There's no middle option. That's basically
But I understand what you're talking about. Like, he could have just said no and took his chances and did your own population, did his time. Maybe try to go protective. Because I think they have the general pop and then they got the protected. And he could have went. But how do you get to protect it? You probably got to snitch with somebody and give some information. So, I mean, it's a gamble. Mm-hmm. And, you're right. He could have said no, took his chances. But I'm pretty sure the way they had it in the movie, he did the calculation. I mean, guy used to be a stockbroker. He seen his odds. And he's like, I guess this is what I got to do. You know, I think when he did, that was a point of no return.
Yeah.
That was definitely a point of no return. That was a point of no return for his character and himself. And the interesting thing about this movie is that a lot of times we live in a very privileged society to where we believe that we have choices. Yeah. But sometimes in life, there are just fucked up situations where you really don't have a choice. You just got to survive the decision. And so, yeah. I took
it partially as his privilege, meaning that they make very clear that he comes from a privileged background. Mm-hmm. It's part of why he was so scared, meaning that he was a good target for them because he's so scared that something's going to happen to him in prison. And so them saying, we'll protect you, is appealing to him versus... If you took a regular guy who was a little bit more of a street guy and put him in that
situation, he would be like,
he might just say, fuck you. Go ahead. Try to kill me. You
know? I'm going to stay next to the guard. What are you eating for lunch, guard? I'm going to have lunch with you. What's going on there?
Basically, in the present day plot, we see Nicolaj's character with Shotgun, who's another of the neo-Nazis, and some other gang members, including this guy named Howie, who is a young Afghanistan war veteran with no criminal record. We get to know Shotgun, who's played by John Bernthal, my favorite actor. And we find out early in the movie he is snitching for this parole officer / cop played by Omari Hardwick. And this is how good of an actor John Bernthal is. So they have this whole subplot where he is like a mole for the cops and he's snitching on the white supremacists. And his motivation for doing it is that his girlfriend Monica is in prison. And if he does this, she will get out of prison. It's a character that we only hear about in dialogue. We never see. Mm-hmm. Not established in any
way. Yeah, you're right. We don't.
Everything about it from a screenwriting perspective, you would say that that's technically not good screenwriting. But John is such a good actor. I totally believed it. I was like, yeah, man, for Monica, come on.
We never even see Monica. Monica might be anything. We have no idea who Monica is. Like.
Were you?
And then we all hear about her trafficking. Like, we don't really know. She could have been trafficking people. Like, she could be a horrible person. He like, she's my love. I love Monica. I'm going to do it for her. Like,
he has this line where he's like, she my life, man. And I was like, man, Shotgun, white supremacist guy. I totally am with you. I hope it works out for you.
Oh man, that was a little bit of a laziness, but you know what? It's so much good writing that you just let it go. You know what I'm saying?
What are they going to do? They can't have 20 minutes on Monica at the top.
That goes nowhere. Monica, I still don't know what she got caught trafficking for. Did they ever explain that?
I mean, the only thing I could guess is like, maybe it's a prostitution charge and just technically.
See, that's what you guess. We're all guessing. And that's the power of the writing because we don't know. Because if she was a sex trafficker of children, they'd be like, oh, fuck that. Leave Monica in jail. Like,
we don't know. We just believe John Bernthal so much. We're like, hey, man, Monica's all right. Come on.
best actor ever. No.
I love John Bernthal. As some of the audience knows, the next podcast is going to be a John Bernthal podcast. So Harlan transfers his finances to his wife. There's a great scene where basically he, you know, wants to give her all this money. And she's like, I don't want it. You know, you haven't talked to me in 7 years. She brings his son to meet him against his wishes. And he kind of holds back from telling him what he really wants to tell him and tries to kind of keep a distance from him. He pretty much closes the door on him. And then we see how distraught he is. Meanwhile, kind of going into the past plot, we're seeing him rise in the prison. He gets the alias money. He gets gang tats. He starts getting swole. And he stabs another inmate during a riot to save the life of the head of the Mexican gang, but it's caught on camera. So now all the gang leaders respect him, but he gets 9 more years. And there's a, they show like the sentencing hearing or whatever. And Lake Bell, is his wife, is there. And she sees the video of him like brutally stabbing this guy.
Yeah.
And he turns to her and he says, "Forget I exist." And his beard has gotten really thick. And at that point, it's just on, right? I mean, there's really no going back then.
Yeah, he is, like I said, it's like he, in he, at that point when he did that, that's, yeah, man, like I said before, he just realizes there's no way out of this. Like, what do you do? And the, and I like how they have all these interrelationship plays between him and the boss, because you're wondering why these people respect him. And like, even when the Mexican cartel comes in, and the first thing he tells the Mexican cartel, you know, like, yo, you have a beautiful family. Mm. And like, yeah, thing. It gives you that little hint of humanity between these men in these very terrible situations. And this movie does that throughout it, through all these little decisions. But yeah, he became a boss. That's how he became a legend. Like, money. Real talk, real money. Prison riots. My sister's a CEO. She talks to me about that all the time. Prison riots, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty wild. They put it to, they're like leading up to the riot, and he's talking to one of the other white supremacists, and he's like, man, at that time he was still more naive. So he's like, I don't want to be in a riot. And the guy's like, just kind of swing and, you know, be in the middle, but don't really do anything. And then at the actual riot, he has no choice but to do something.
Yeah.
I just thought it was so funny how they,
that was a good set. That's like a salesman. Like, in the middle. Yeah. Yeah. That was a salesman tech. Like, oh yeah, don't worry. That car is fine. Isn't it? Don't worry about those tires. You'll be all right.
The guards definitely murder someone during that riot, right? Like, they shoot somebody, then, I think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they do.
Oh, yeah. I wonder, you know, yeah, they just, it's indifference. Like, they're just a bunch of criminals and nobody's going to miss them. So, yeah, fire into the crowd. And it, actually, yeah, they hit a few people and they showed them dead, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's prison life, man. Prison life.
Doc Collar. Not a great ad for prison.
No, but you know what? This movie, I don't know if you have taken this like parallel, but what this movie also does is, like, remember, he was only supposed to get 16 months, right? But when he gets into the system, he ends up doing, you know, nine plus years, whatever. And that goes, there's actually a lot of criminal reform action about that. That's how I think, what was the kid that got locked up in Rikers? He was a black guy. He got locked up for something simple. And then he just kept getting beat up in jail and went on and on. And he ended up killing himself.
Mm. It's a Netflix documentary about it, I think. Yeah.
Yes. And you know, the name's not coming to me right now. I'm pretty sure the comments will probably have it. But that movie, like this whole prison reform thing, you know, people going to jail and like even Shawshank Redemption says, shit, I didn't know how to be a criminal, so I went to jail. Like, yeah. So anyway, but I was always surprised about the guy, the Beast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beast in the actual, like, that's a, he ran the prison for 50, he ran California for 15 years from a freaking cell where he only got 1 hour of daylight.
I love Beast. Let's save Beast for the second half of the show.
Okay, okay, okay.
Break for our sponsor. We are going to be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed. You get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. Their pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So yeah, so Harlan is transferred to Corcoran State Prison under maximum security. And there he is introduced to an inmate called the Beast, who commands the Aryan Brotherhood, the top of the white prison gang hierarchy. Impressed with Harlan's dedication, the Beast promotes him to second in command. And the Beast is played by a guy named Holt McElhaney. Myron, have you seen Mindhunter?
Yeah. Hell yeah.
So you know how different he is in Mindhunter versus him. It's almost unrecognizable.
Wait. Which guy was he in Mindhunter?
He was the guy. He was Tench. He was like the older guy of the two cops.
Oh, snap. I didn't even put that together till you just said that.
That's how good an actor
is. Yeah. He was frightful in that, as a Beast, bro.
Yeah, I mean,
he was a beast.
For the audience, for anyone who hasn't seen Mindhunter, he plays the most like down to earth, you know, blue collar dude. Yeah. Mindhunter.
And then I loved him in Mindhunter.
Yeah, he is the most loathsome white supremacist. He has a massive beard. You can't even really see his face. He's like fully tatted his entire body. And he talks to Harlan about books a lot. He's like, yeah, I love to read. I'm going to send you all the books I like. He's like, at first he sort of charms him, but then later, basically what ends up happening is that he wants him to do this weapons deal. And Harlan kind of is like, hey, you know, I'm going to be on parole. Like, and he's like, hold on a second. And literally all he says, it's pretty reasonable. He's like, isn't this a bad idea? I'm going to be on parole. And he's like, you should consider your family before you, like, this is like the first thing he asked him to do.
Has
the slightest hesitation. And basically the guy was like, we'll murder your family if you don't do this. You're on parole.
Man, this world, like the tenseness of it is just, I think that's why Shot Caller is such a special film. Just the tense of everything and the reality and the grittiness of it, even a dialogue, even like a say, like they call somebody a dirt leg. Like I even know what a dirt leg was until I watched this movie. You know what I mean? Just like,
shit, I don't know what it is, but like, you believe it. That's one of the things that I always tell people about writing dialogue and stuff is like, if you do enough research and find some term like that, right, which I'm sure is a real term, just getting that one term in, now you have authority and we believe you. So the rest of it, they could have completely made it up and I would totally buy it. Like they could be, it could be the dirt leg is not a real term at all. There's one part where Holt McElhaney tells the guard, get this lame away from me. Talking about Nicolaj. And I was like, that's such a weirdly soft, he's not even using curse word. That must be a white supremacist thing. Cause why would you wouldn't even say like a curse?
Hey, I'm going to be honest with you. Like I called the number, right? And I guess I called the wrong number and it was a brother on the other line. And you could tell he's probably a big brother. Like, you know, sometimes from voice, you can hear like, oh, this dude is real. And he called me a weirdo because I was trying to figure out who called me. Like I didn't call you. You called me. And we're going through that whole back and forth. He called me a weirdo. And I got to admit, I'm like, I've been called a lot of things. I've been called an MF or this, that. But he called me a weirdo. I'm like, what? It kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
It's worse. So I would have rather he cursed me.
Yeah. Hey, before we move on, though, this is one thing I gotta mention, okay? Omari Hardwick in the movie, he's good in the movie. And what I wanted to also touch on is that, and I know I'm going back, but we'll go back to that. In the beginning of the movie, when you're introduced to his character, he takes three bullets to the chest. And in that moment he takes three bullets to the chest, he hears the little girl screams and he pops out of his own pains, end up killing the guy. The reason why I wanted to say that is because you're talking about all these, if you just look at the cast of actors that they have, like, and you blew my mind right now when you talked about the guy with the same guy from Mindhunters because he was unrecognizable. This movie was just such a platform for so many actors to just break out of a mold.
Mm.
And they did it amazingly.
Yeah, Omari, but what is Omari known from? I know his face.
He's known, well, you know what? He was at Ava DuVernay, Middle of Nowhere. Mm. He did a lot of Ava DuVernay, like, first films. Then he did that one with Dwayne Rock Johnson where he was taking over the juvenile facility Omari played the bad guy.
Is he on Power?
He is on Power, exactly. Yeah. He was the main guy on Power. So Omari, in the Black community, he's kind of well known. He's been a rising star for a while, but he's starting to get his just. Now he's on Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, he's got a role there. That guy is really he's underrated.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so many people underrated. Just, but yeah, he's pretty, he's consistent. But lame, yeah. That's a pretty lame one.
Speaking of
lame, being called a weirdo, but being called a weirdo is kind of will kind of mess you up too. So
on the day of the weapons deal, Harlan escapes. He's under surveillance from the cops. He goes to Shotgun's house, kills Shotgun. He's figured out the Shotgun is a snitch. And when John Bernthal dies, he says, "I ain't no punk," and then he dies. And it's like, it felt so real to me because it's very much like this Western thing of you're still trying to define your legacy even as you're dying.
Yeah.
He is a punk. Like, in the context of this world, he's a punk.
He's a snitch. He's a worse. Killed. He's a rat. He's a rat, yeah.
He's a rat. It's like you still empathize with him even as he's dying. I was so impressed with what they did with his character.
Yeah, I think what ends up happening when you start getting toward the end of the movie, I mean, everybody is three-dimensional. So you feel, because, you know, it's like everybody is, you know, and it was kind of cool because remember, Shotgun was actually superior to Money when they first met.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, Shotgun was an OG when they first met, and then Money surpassed him. So that was kind of like a very interesting thing for him to even have to deal with, you know what I mean? Because it's like, wow, this dude used to be a little punk on the yard. Now he running and telling me what to do. And so
they did it very elegantly because there's a part in the prison where he's like, "Hey, listen, you're going to smuggle this heroin up your ass." And Harlan is like, "Huh?" And he's like, "We got a problem." And then later in the present day, there's something that Harlan needs from Shotgun. And Shotgun hesitates for a second, and he's like, "Hey, we got a problem." And
It's when they're breaking down the deal. Like, they're breaking down the deal. They're trying to break down the deal, and they're in the club. And he says, "We're going to get this stuff. We're going to get the location like an hour before." And you can see Shotgun do the slightest eye roll, and fucking, he's on it. Like, "Do we have a problem?" I was like, "Whoa, he is sharp." And then he just kept his eye on him the whole time,
just from that, It's incredible. All right. Well, I'm going to zip ahead in the plot so we stay on time. So basically, Kutcher, which is Amari Hardwick's character, finds Shotgun's body, gets his cell phone. After meeting the Mexican gangsters, Harlan texts their coordinates to Shotgun's cell phone. Realizing that Shotgun hid more of the weapons to sell himself, Harlan warns Howie to basically get out of this vehicle they're in. And because of him doing that, Howie is not there when the cops kind of swarm in, which Harlan set up. He basically set himself up to get arrested and for everybody to get arrested, except for this young kid who had no criminal record. Fully validated now, Harlan is sentenced to life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. He turns down Kutcher's offer to testify against the Beast in exchange for a full pardon. He is returned to Corcoran, where this corrupt prison guard they've been working with brings him to the Beast. And the Beast pretty much says, like, "Hey, we're going to kill your family. I figured out that you did this on purpose, blah, blah, blah." Harlan has smuggled in. This is like, they set this up. So he gets like the one slither of a razor from a razor you would shave with, puts that in a chapstick tube, puts that up his ass. Again, one more thing up the ass for the road. And basically sneaks that into the prison. And so when he confronts the Beast, he takes out the razor, ends up like killing the Beast. But before he kills him, this is the part I love too. Were you surprised by this? So the Beast sees what's happening, figures all this out, sees that they're going to have to fight and that he kind of planned all this. And he goes, "Well played. Let's get down, Wood." Were you surprised that his reaction to the absolute betrayal that will almost certainly kill him was being like, "Good job, bro"?
No, you know what's scary about that? The thing that's crazy about that is that he understands the world. He understands. I mean, 15 years, who knows? Maybe this guy wanted somebody to finally take him out. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe, because it gets to a point to where when you see so much death and so much despair in the world and everything else, and you see it, and finally, it might have been a thing of honor for, like, okay, at least if I'm on a guy, this is the guy that's taking me out, and I feel that my legacy is taken care of. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, you know how you talk about, like, there's like the Troy movie, right? Troy, Brad Pitt goes to war because it's the greatest war ever, but he knows that he's going to die. And like, I think with the Beast character, the psychology of him, I think a guy like that sees so much death, so many weak people that he knows he's always known his time was coming. And in a way, this guy impressed him. It was kind of like a acknowledgement, like, okay, if this is how it goes down, I'm still not going to give it to you easy, but I respect it.
It's a good death.
It's a good death. Mm. And, you know, it's so hard for, you know, in Western society, because my mother, she works at a hospice, right? So she deals with people that dies a lot.
Yeah.
And she made a very interesting notion. She said, you know what? In America, nobody teaches you how to die, even though we know that's a big part of life, right? But when you're in these men's lives that deal with it on a daily basis, these guys have a different level that they're thinking on. So for us, we're like, oh my God, he's about to die. But this guy has been, he's been thinking about his death probably for 10 years.
Hmm.
And finally, this is his masterpiece. Like, okay, if I go, this is how it's going to go. This dude did it. All right, fuck it. Let's go.
And it's almost like he earned it in a way, right? Like,
yeah.
The whole white supremacist thing, we kind of hear that from the beginning. It's like, well, you finally really went all in on this. And it's like, if somebody's going to be the boss, it might as well be you. You figured it out.
You ain't getting out of jail. It's like, we ain't got to worry about you running and snitching. Like, you can't go nowhere. Like, shit, maybe.
So Harlan, they have this fight. He basically says, hey, nobody's touching my family. Kills the beast. Tells the prison guard, hey, this was self-defense. The prison guard's like, all right, cool, no problem. And now he becomes the boss. His family's safety is secured. He accepts. He's got this life sentence. He tells Kutcher about the remaining weapons as a favor. Gets a letter from his son saying that, hey, you know what? Me and mom are moving on. I forgive you. He kind of looks at the pictures of his family. And we sort of know, well, you know, sure, he's going to be the white supremacist boss by himself for the next 30 years. But at least his kid and his wife are safe. And then he's just exercising in Beast's cage. And that's the last shot of the movie. Did you find the ending of this movie satisfying or sad or both?
Oh, man, it was just. It was conflicting. It was very conflicting because it's got this weird thing like. The rise to power, right? It's got this weird thing with the rise to power, and we're kind of rooting for him, this really weird way for him to rise to power, but the cost of power, like, I think Kanye West had this amazing quote where he says, do you have enough, he talked about power, but he said, do you have the power to let power go? He has a notion like that, like, do you have the power to let power go? Hmm. And that's why you say, you asked me, how do I feel about the ending? It's like fucking despair. Like, okay, he rose to power, he's lonely, but at least he has that condolence. At least he has that condolence in the moment with his son, because that's what it started off with, letter to his son. And he finally gets the letter back, which lets him know that he can move on. And this is his life moving on, which is sucks, but.
I think you touched on something really interesting, which is that there's like, I think there's like 5% of you as an audience member where you're like, way to go, man. Like, he's going to be the white supremacist boss. It's just that American dream thing where we as Americans are so cultured to be like, success at all costs, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. And that's the thing. Like, there's the thing about it, we're so programmed for success that no matter how twisted and how like colluded the success is, we're rooting for it. Hell yeah, he killed the boss. Well, he got power. He's going to be in jail for his life. Yeah, but he did it.
It's very much like Scarface, right? Became like this icon for people. And if you watch the movie Scarface, it's like an extreme tragedy. He kills his like best friend and he dies like horribly. The woman in his life doesn't even like him. There's nothing good about the guy.
But this is what we have to realize too, is that there's so many people that feel impotent and powerless that any notion of power they would like to have. So the fact that Scarface dies at the end, that's the price paid for that brief moment in his life of power.
Yeah.
And that's what people are gravitating to, because so many people in life do not think about it. People have a boss, people have a wife, people have kids, people have all these things where you have no control and no power in your own life. So the fantasy of having some power to exert some control over your life and self is so intriguing. It's so, and we want it so bad to where even when it's in a situation like shock collar, we will gravitate to it.
Yeah, it's wild. What a testament to the writing. Okay, that is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. If you dig the show, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a big help to the show. And if you're a monthly supporter of the show, feel free to request an episode at any time. I want to thank my guest, Myron Ward. Until next time, bye-bye.